Today's speaker is Dr. Peter Victor. He is the professor of environmental studies at York University. He is an economist and he has worked on environmental issues for over 40 years.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. So do we even know who plants the seed? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling fruit.
The other side of the news.
Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor. Till freedom is a rumor.
Once again, Environment Hamilton has provided the city with an excellent speaker at its annual general meeting. Dr. Peter Victor has a new book out called Managing Without Growth. What he's trying to get us to think about is making policy that doesn't have growth in it. I know that's an unusual concept because we've been trained for so many years that that's the only way we can have a society. But it's killing us. It's killing the planet. It's killing our environment. What he says is rich countries should turn away from economic growth as the primary policy objective. Continued economic growth all over the world is unrealistic due to the environmental and resource constraints, not to mention the damage. He also says, moreover, economic growth has not brought full employment. It has not eliminated poverty. It has not reduced the burden of the economy on the environment. And now, here's Dr. Peter Victor.
Okay, well, look, thank you very much for inviting me to come and speak to you tonight. I'm hoping now that my contribution to the evening will really add something for your benefit. Now, one of the things that impressed me about the organization is you are really very active and seemingly effective at the local level. And in a way, that's where all change takes place, is at the local level. And so I really applaud and admire what you're doing. What you're going to find out from my work, though, is I tend to operate at a macro level, sort of the larger landscape. And one of the reasons is that's partly because that's, in a way, what I've been trained to do. But secondly, over my career, either I've made suggestions or usually other people have made suggestions of things that we really ought to do, often to do with the environment, sometimes to do with poverty. It doesn't really matter what the issue is. And I just got fed up hearing so many times, well, we like the idea, but what's it going to do for growth? Or that will hurt growth. Or sometimes they'll disguise it and say that's bad for productivity or bad for competitiveness or bad for trade. So I set out a few years ago to see whether we could manage without growth. I think it's a very important question to try to come up with an answer to, because I think we may very well find we're going to have to manage without growth, whether we like it or not. So that's explains, in a sense, the subtitle of the book, Slower by Design, because I think we'll prefer that, than by disaster if it's thrust upon us. So I've boiled my presentation down to 9 main points. The first is to put forward the view that the economy is best understood as a subsystem of the biosphere. The second is that the economy, broadly speaking, is putting an excessive burden on the biosphere. Thirdly, that we can't simply look to prices to give us the right signals to tell us what we should and shouldn't do. Prices don't really carry very valid information anymore. Fourthly, technology has certainly got a key role to play, but it's by no means sufficient. What follows from that is that we have to address the scale of our economy as well as the intensity with which it operates. Technology and intensity are very, very much related. I want to point out that there are, in fact, a lot of people questioning growth, and I'm very glad to see this happening, so that this is part of a dialogue that we can all participate in. Remind us all that we live on a very unequal world, and for that reason alone, it makes sense for a rich country like Canada to take the lead. Then I'll talk a bit about some of the computer work that I've done, the scenarios, the model building that suggests that we can in fact manage without growth. And finally, I'll talk about some of the things that would change if we were to embark upon such a path. And it's really at that level that we begin to make the link really between the sorts of activities your organization does and the larger sort of macro scale analysis that I provide. So let's just go through these one by one. Some of the problems that are being created because of the damage that we're doing to the environment emanate from our economy. And so it's important to understand the economy if we're to understand, you know, why are we causing these problems and what can we do about them. We are interfering with it in many ways. There are many other biophysical cycles on the planet that are less visible in this way that we're also interrupting. Now, it was said in the introduction that I'm an economist, and it's true. And I have to say that I envy people who have a strong natural science background and come to environmental issues very accustomed to imagery of this sort. If you've ever taken any economics, firms and households interact. Firms supply the goods and services the households buy. Households, the ultimate owners of the land, labor, and capital in our economy, they supply that to the firms, and the money goes in the other direction. This is still the typical way in which economics is introduced, and the economy is introduced to students of economics. It's okay. It's got, though, one major flaw if you want to understand the environment and the economy and how they relate. There is no environment. It's invisible. It's been missed out. And so if this is your worldview, if this is what you ultimately think an economy is about, of course, you can break it down to a lot more detail, it's pretty hopeless for understanding the relationships between the economy and the environment. So we have to put in some of the things that are missing, because the economy is a subsystem of the biosphere, something that Herman Daly, whose name came up before, has been teaching us for a long time, and I think now we have to get this message far and wide. So to drive the economy, to run any economy, you need materials of various kinds drawn from the natural environment. You need energy, and you need environmental goods and services, things like pollination and flood control, things that are provided to us gratis by nature and without which the economy could not function. But one of the things we know is that all of the material and energy that we take into the economy ultimately leaves. These are basic laws of physics, that we don't create or destroy anything, we reduce the quality. So at the upper end we have the materials and energy having been used being discarded back into the environment. And when these flows of material and energy through the economy are small, well, maybe it's okay to ignore them. And when I was starting out in economics in the 60s, I was simply told by my teachers that air and water are abundant. They're not scarce. They don't really come into economics. Well, that obviously is not right now, and it wasn't even right then. If we do damage to the environment because we overload it, we start interfering with these biophysical cycles that I mentioned before, and that can feed back on the capacity of the environment to support the economy. And all this is taking place on planet Earth. This is the image of an economy that I subscribe to, and if you don't remember anything else from what I say tonight, it would be really nice if you could sort of remember this picture of the economy as a subsystem of the biosphere. What's happening now is that we're placing an excessive burden on the biosphere. It's not too surprising once you have that image and you know how rapidly our economies have grown over the years. This is a picture that came from an article in Nature in, I think, October last year. And it's the result of a bunch of scientists getting together and saying that they identified major issues, thresholds that we should not cross. Climate change, ocean acidification, stratospheric ozone depletion, and so on all the way around. They said to ensure as best as we could that we don't cross these thresholds, we should establish planetary boundaries, sort of on the safe side of the threshold. That can be understood as this sort of safe operating space, this green area in the middle of the picture. And what they conclude, based upon the evidence that's available, is that we've gone beyond the safe operating space of the planet with respect to climate change, the nitrogen cycle, and biodiversity loss, and we're beginning to move out there from some of the others as well. So this is a really frightening image, because it's sort of simple, but we've got to think now about our economic system, which is causing these problems. Let me give you some historical data just to sort of flesh this out a bit. This is a graph. It goes from 1900 to 2005, and it shows the global extraction of materials over that period in billions of tons. So this is the first 50 years, and you can see that the total extraction of materials doubled in 50 years. Well, that was significant, and you can see the composition, his biomass, his fossil fuels, and industrial ores, the small sliver. So that doubled in 50 years. Look what happened in the next 50 years. Went up by 700%. I mean, this is a massive, massive change which inevitably has adverse effects on the planet. Two or three people have mentioned peak oil. I don't have to dwell on it with this audience, but this is just a quick illustration of what the peak oil issue is about. The red diamonds illustrate the discovery of oil from conventional sources on an annual basis, and you'll see that the peak discovery year was in the 60s. About 1964-65, more oil discovered that year than any other year, and since then it's been in decline. Meanwhile, extraction has been rising until we reached about 1990, when production began to exceed discoveries. Well, you can't produce oil you haven't found, So for a while, we can continue to produce amounts that are greater than we're discovering on an annual basis, but eventually this is going to come down. And there's a lot of debate about whether we've actually reached the peak or whether it will be in the next 5, 10, 20 years. Most people, most commentators, put the peak year before 2030. Here's a wonderful report on PCORD, if this is a topic that interests you. It's available on the internet by Steve Sorrell, a very comprehensive review of a vast number of peak oil studies done by a guy who I don't think really had an opinion one way or the other going into it. Here are his three of his conclusions. The first is that peak before 2030 appears likely and a significant risk before 2020. Secondly, just to put this in perspective, just to maintain current production, we have to bring on 3 million barrels a day of new capacity every year. That's equivalent to finding a new Saudi Arabia every 3 years. That's tough to do, and that's just to maintain current production. And then the third point is that the risks of global oil depletion are really not being attended to by the research community and the policy community. Peak oil is a big problem, and if you look at the history of economic growth, it's been so closely related to access to cheap fossil fuels, and in the last number of decades that's been particularly oil. So when the price of oil, if it does shoot up, as some of us expect it will, as the peak is arrived at, the economic implications are quite dramatic. Just to say how this is now quite a mainstream view, this is the chief economist of the International Energy Agency, which is an arm of the OECD. All the rich countries belong to it. And look what he's saying. You know, if we just carry on as we are, we're likely to see the peak before 2020. The International Energy Agency wasn't saying that 3 years ago. Well, now he's coming out and saying it. So we've got to make an energy transition. Great opportunity for Hamilton here, and I'm sure you've got some ideas about that, and you maybe have even begun to do it. But at the sort of more global level, this is what the picture looks like, because we've done energy transitions before. We went from wood, first of all, to coal to drive those monstrous steam engines that James Watt worked on and others did. And then subsequently we branched out into other fossil fuels, and we started producing electricity, which of course is really a secondary source of energy. I just want to make 2 points about this diagram. One is that transition from coal up to the present time took about 200 years, and during that time the amount of energy we ended up using is 20 times greater than when we were just using coal. If we're talking about making a transition now, say in half a century, we've got to do it when we're looking at a much greater use of energy. So it's a very, very tough problem. The second thing is, when we move through this transition, typically we were moving from a less convenient energy source to a more convenient energy source, a cleaner one, and often a cheaper one. The trouble is with renewables, and I'm a great supporter of renewables, often they're not that convenient to use. You have to work really hard to bring the energy together, like with these solar collectors, photovoltaics. Storage is not an easy problem to solve. They're not cheaper unless there's government intervention in many cases. And so we've got these obstacles to overcome. I believe they can be overcome, but they require quite a lot of policy interventions for that to happen. So that's a big part of the story. Okay, so I said we use materials, we use energy, we also create environmental problems. Impossible to give a talk like this without at least having one slide on the greenhouse effect. So here's a graph of average temperature, average global temperature, going back to 500. Of course, this is what they call a proxy reconstruction. And then over here we have actual measurement. And then we've got the IPCC, a range of scenarios running from a low of a 2 degree on average temperature up to 6 degrees. Plus, and the consequences of that kind of change in the average temperature are really quite disturbing. What is Canada doing about it? Well, this is interesting because this comes from the National Roundtable on Economy and Environment and a report they did in 2007. What it shows is the top line is their projection of Canada's greenhouse gas emissions if we kind of go on as we have been. Here's what they think we ought to do. And then here's how we should fill the gap. What's interesting about this graph is that if we weren't growing, we could do it all by fuel switching. In other words, switching to renewables and maybe some conservation. But it's because we're growing, we're having to put all this money into carbon capture and sequestration. So there's a connection here, you see, between how aggressive we have to be to deal with the problem and its connection to economic growth. On the question of ecosystem goods and services, this was a major study. I'm sure some of you at least have looked at it. The Millennium Ecosystem Assessment, published in 2005. This is the very first conclusion from that assessment. Look at it. Approximately 60% of the ecosystem services examined in their very comprehensive report are being degraded or used unsustainably. And there's a list. So the economies are putting this tremendous pressure on the planet.
and we're going to have to do something about our economies. This is a graph of the ecological footprint. Just another way of indicating the pressures that we're putting on the planet. This scale on this graph is numbers of planets. Well, we've only got the one. So there's the world biocapacity, and the estimate is that sometime in the mid-70s, and this date moves around a little bit, depending on what year you get the graph for, but sometime in the mid-70s, maybe up to 1980, we reached the point where the planet was had an ecological footprint just about equal to the capacity of the planet to support us. Beyond that, we went into overshoot. Now, you'll see that a good chunk of this overshoot is due to the carbon footprint. So it's not as if this is a different story. It's another way of saying some of the same story I've already been saying. But it's not just carbon. It's the pressure we put on all the other categories of land as well. So, again, pretty clear indication that our economies are just oversized and inefficient and present a challenge to us. This is another way of telling the story. This is an index of about 5,000 different populations of getting up to now 2,000 species of mammals and birds and so on, and you can see how it's been in decline. And you can see some of the species that have gone extinct. You know, when I see this, and I have shown it many times and seen it many times, I'm reminded that we have a fundamental ethical problem to tackle here as well. I mean, we're one species of, what, 20 million, 30 million, and we're just crowding out the others. It raises issues that we tend not to face up to, but I do believe that we should. Canada's contribution. Well, you know, this story is pretty familiar. For 100 years or so, the catch of the Atlantic cod rose steadily, but not dramatically. And then came the new technology. I love this because I'm always told by people who don't really see the problem the way I do, that technology is the answer. All right, well, it was new technology, and it sure knew how to catch fish. Trouble is the fish didn't breed any faster to serve the vessels, so it collapsed. So, you know, there's lots more to say about technology, and I have a bit more to say about it tonight, but it isn't the savior automatically. I said I'd comment on prices. Well, prices are the bread and butter of economics, understanding how they're formed and what they mean. And we like to think that prices could tell us the truth, that if something is expensive, that at least is in part because it was expensive to make. If something is cheap, it was cheap to make. The trouble is that a lot of things that appear cheap to us are now not really cheap. It's just that a lot of the costs of production were not included. They are the main conveyor of information in our economy, and they are used in the calculation of GDP, which is the gross domestic product, which is the standard measure of growth that I'll come back to later. Economists understand very well the conditions that have to be met for prices to convey accurate information, and we also know that these conditions are not met in practice, and increasingly not met in practice. And even if they were, prices are what we would call efficient. They're not fair. And I think when we talk about environment, as you well know, we're into issues of fairness and justice as much as we are into issues of efficiency. So we can't rely just on prices. Let me say something about technology. It's a science museum in London. Free to go into, unlike the ROM. Technology is helpful but not sufficient. Let me give you some examples, historical examples of what's happened to technology. That's what a computer looked like in 1946. I happened to pick that year because that's when I was born. I had to start somewhere, pretty dismal looking world, lots of people looking at a huge amount of machinery that was about as powerful as a four-function calculator. By the time I was doing my doctorate in economics, the world was now in color and the equipment was better. One thing about 1970, quite a few people in this room remember 1970. That's as far in the past as 2050 is in the future. We kind of think 2050, we got time. Maybe we think that. It doesn't seem that long ago. So that's a bit of a sobering thought. By 1992, which is the year that our first year students at the university were born, this is kind of what computers were looking like, and now something like that. Telephones. They are. Telephone 1946. The world went into color. 92 into cordless, and now who'd know? I mean, if this is what you thought a phone was, you wouldn't know what this is. You wouldn't know how to operate or anything. I asked my students the other day, I said, do you still talk about dialing a number on one of these things? And some of them said, yes. And I said, oh, well, there you are. That's where it comes from. All that technology I just showed you is fantastic, and it's all about miniaturization. But miniaturization has made this kind of thing possible. You couldn't design it, you couldn't build it, and you couldn't operate it without computers. So miniaturization isn't automatically good for the environment because it allows us to do grand technology. Look at that, the world's biggest digger, a monster. But it couldn't do it without miniaturization. This is a typical urban landscape, and look what they added to it. Yeah, world's tallest building. Funny thing is, after they had it open about a week, they had to close it down because they couldn't run all the elevators. The micro stuff would let them down. Look at this one. It's not just that it's such an amazing piece of technology to look at. It's what the project engineer had to say about it. This is the most environmentally friendly cruise ship to date. It's more efficient than other similar ships. He's thinking in terms of impact per person if it's full. But even then, if this thing arrives at one of those Caribbean islands and, you know, 3,000 or 4,000 people get off, I don't think it's a very friendly ship at all. Talking about technology, we need to pay some attention to William Stanley Jevons. He's an economist who conventional economists admire because of some of his work and despise because of other parts of his work. I actually like him for both parts of his work. But he talks about the dilemma that sometimes when you make something more efficient, you make its use cheaper, and as a result, people make more use of it. And so where you thought you were saving, you end up not saving. So here's a quote from Stanley Jevons. It says, "Wholly a confusion of ideas to suppose that the economical use of fuel is equivalent to a diminished consumption. The very contrary is the truth." He was thinking of the steam engine, which had become a lot more efficient by the time he was writing than when James Watt made his efficiency improvements. And he could just calculate that so much more coal was being used to run steam engines in Britain in the mid-19th century than in the mid-18th century. It justified this statement. Now we know a lot more about the rebound effect. I mean, he threw this comment in and largely got ignored for 100 years. Here's a nice graph from a report from the UK Energy Research Council. The idea being that if we make a car more efficient, it will use less energy. The rebound effect has many dimensions. Well, that may induce people to drive further because it doesn't cost that as much as they thought, so they end up using more energy. Maybe not overwhelming the reduction in energy, but certainly reducing it. Then we have the indirect rebound effect. It may take more energy to make the energy-efficient equipment in the first place. That's true in some cases. And then we have another aspect. If you're saving money by driving your energy-efficient car, how are you going to spend it? Well, if you spend it on holidays in Spain, you end up using more energy. So the rebound effect is a very serious problem and tends to undermine attempts to solve our problems by increases in efficiency. In his study, this is another study by Steve Sorrell, he estimates that the rebound effect typically takes away half of the savings we think we're going to get from energy efficiency. Okay, so that means efficiency alone is not going to solve the problem. We have to address scale, the size of the economy. Efficiency and intensity are reciprocal of one another. Efficiency might be how much gross domestic product can we produce for every ton of greenhouse gas we emit. And if we try and bring that down by becoming, or we make that a bigger number by becoming more efficient. With intensity, we do it, how much greenhouse gas do we have to emit per dollar of GDP? So that's the measure I'm going to need for dealing with climate change, ignoring scale. Time goes from 1980 to 2005, and it shows you what's been happening to material use at the global level. Intensity has gone down by 29%. In other words, we're using less material per dollar of production. Trouble is, world production overall went up by 110%. Environmental impact depends on these two parameters, the intensity of the activity and its scale. See how even though there's been a reduction in energy intensity, in other words, less energy used per dollar of production, total energy use has gone up. So I want to now talk about green growth. It's a term that comes about or is mentioned a lot and often without definition. And I'm doing it with these concepts of scale and intensity. So this is what Canada's gross domestic product was, which is simply a measure of what we buy in the economy as consumers and as businesses buying equipment and governments. And I'll say a bit more about that later. But this is what the gross domestic product was in 1990, just under 900. And this is what our greenhouse gas intensity was. So on average, we were producing about 0.7 kilotons of greenhouse gas per $1 million of what we bought in the economy. You multiply that intensity by that scale and you get the 592 megatons of greenhouse gases that we released in 1990. We could have released the same amount of greenhouse gases if the economy had been bigger and the intensity had been lower. So to make that easy, I just joined them all up. Now we're from this, any point on this red line is a combination of the size of the economy and the intensity of the economy that gives us 592 megatons of greenhouse gases. If we're on this side of it, they're combinations which are giving us more than 592, and if we're on this side, it's lower than 592. So we can use this now to define green growth, because if we're starting here, then green growth is a movement anywhere into this segment, because the economy is, at least it's not shrinking, as long as it stays at this line or above,
and intensity is declining, the combination is a reduction in greenhouse gases. So that's my definition of green growth. But if you can have green growth, you can have brown growth. You've still got a reduction in intensity if you move in this direction, but the economy is growing so fast that it overwhelms the reduction in intensity. So total greenhouse gas emissions go up.
Well, you know, there's no stopping me now. I can fill out all these seconds. Here's black growth, where both have gone in that direction. Then there's
what happens if we shrink the economy? There's now a language to describe this. It's called degrowth.
And I'll mention that again later. But you can reduce the size of the economy, and if you do that, you can allow yourself, if you want, some increase in intensity. As long as it's not too great, you'll reduce total emissions. But even that can be messed up. You can get black degrowth. So now I use this to look at what have we done in the past, what might we do in the future. So here's, now turning to the USA, here's their 1990 gross domestic product. I picked 1990, of course, because it's the base year for Kyoto. And there was their intensity, about 0.86. And every dot I'm going to put on this graph is the data for an annual year starting from 1990. And you'll see what the Americans did. There's an example of brown growth. The economy is growing fast, intensity is declining, but not fast enough. And so in the end, 2007, which is the latest year we can get data for still, you can see how much more greenhouse gas the Americans are putting out. But to say, well, it's not a problem because we've reduced intensity, of course, doesn't tell the full story. Here's the graph for Britain. Britain had a Kyoto target, which meant they were going to get down from 773 megatons to some level of 676. So anywhere on that purple line gives that result. Economy can grow as long as intensity falls even faster. Here's the British story. Now, I've shown this graph in England, and it's the high point of the presentation, as far as they're concerned. They're wonderful. They don't know how they did it, but they've done it. And they switched to natural gas, really what they did. You can do that once, you can't do it a second time. Here's Canada. You know what they say about us sometimes? We're a bit like the Brits because we had a Kyoto target, and we behave like Americans. Yeah, it's very sad. That worse proportionally. So now what I want to do is I want to take this point and say this is where we are now, more or less. It might be a little bit lower because of the recession, but it's somewhere in that range. And I'm going to put it over here. This is where we are. And I'm just going to say what we're looking at over the next 50 years is trying to get down to something way, way less. So I picked an 87% reduction for reasons that I don't have to go into, but you'll get the point of the slide, whether it's 87% or 80% or 90%. Let's pick the 87%. So how do we get from here over to here? Well, if we do it with green growth, we want to somehow inhabit this segment here. If we do it with no growth, it means we sort of travel along this line because the economy doesn't get any bigger, but intensity gets smaller. So let me just show you that. If we did that, we'd have to get our greenhouse gas intensity down to 0.07 from 0.57. That means for every dollar of output of the Canadian economy to meet this target, we would only be able to put out 13% of the greenhouse gases that we now put out. That's a very, very ambitious goal. It requires a massive transformation of our economy. But that's with no growth. If you grow at 2%, I'm afraid it gets a lot harder. You've now got to reduce the intensity to 5% of what it is today. But 3% is really what we've been used to with our economic growth. You'd have to essentially get rid of all greenhouse gases from the economy in 50 years. That's a very tough challenge, and it's sort of a sort of entree into why I think it's important to look at whether we can manage with a lower or no growth so that we can tackle problems of this sort, which get overwhelmed as we keep trying to increase the scale of the economy. So there are many people questioning growth. Here's some extracts from the newspapers, many of which you'll recognize over the last year or so. The Montreal Gazette, Globe and Mail, Harper's, Wall Street Journal. How about that? New limits to growth, they got them worried. Here's Paul Krugman, Nobel Prize economist, running out of planet to exploit. The New Scientist devoted a whole issue to the folly of growth not that long ago. Here's The Guardian in Britain, the world facing a natural resources crisis worse than financial crunch. That's the Christian Science Monitor. Here's The Star again. Here's Spiegel. This isn't just happening, of course, in North America. Can economies function without growth? Even The Economist got worried about it over Christmas. Progress and its perils. Now, quite a few people have written books about this. I'll just mention one. Here's a report by the UK's Sustainable Development Commission prosperity without growth. Interestingly enough, they put a question mark at the end. It's now been published as a book by the major writer. He dropped the question mark. The question mark was there to sort of pacify the government. That's true, actually. It's reached Facebook, the Center for the Advancement of the Steady State Economy. And they've got a very interesting petition on there that your organization may wish to sign. Many organizations have signed it. I suggest you take a look at that. It's a petition about growth. Here's a very recent report, Growth Isn't Possible, Why We Need a New Economic Direction. And there are many more. But I just do this to show, you know, there's a dialogue happening, and it's really good to be part of it. You know that character? He was interested in how we should measure progress. It's all part of the same set of issues. He asked these two Nobel laureates in economics to answer that question. They came up with this report, Mismeasuring Our Lives, Why the GDP Doesn't Add Up. This is available free on the internet. Here's a quote from the report, and it's in some ways just a summary of what I'm now going to continue to say about my own work. They say, it may not be possible to increase the production, especially of goods, beyond limit, because of the environmental damage that this would entail. As society progresses, it is not unreasonable to expect people to enjoy some of the fruit of that progress in the form of leisure. Work less, we may still be able to do very nicely. What's significant about this, as much as anything else, is the authors. I mean, these are really highly regarded economists in the mainstream, and they're prepared to go on record saying things of this sort. Further indication that this is a widespread or growing debate, here's a conference I went to just a couple of months ago called Growth in Transition. This was in Vienna. What's significant here is some of the funders. The Bank of Austria is funding it. Here's the Ministry of Finance of Austria funding a conference on the growth in transition. This is very, very significant. I mentioned degrowth before. Look at this one, the second conference on economic degrowth for ecological sustainability and social equity. This is in Barcelona. Now, you have to understand how awkward I feel writing about this stuff and getting invited to these conferences. It's just that that happens and I go. But so this was in Barcelona about 2 weeks ago. But it's very conflicting, of course. And I do try to give more of my presentations by video, but neither of these people were that interested in that. Okay. Seventh point. We've got nine. Here's number seven. Just a quick reminder that we live in a very unequal world, and so my work on managing without growth is directed very much at the rich countries. Here are four families: Germany, Ecuador, Bhutan, and Chad. And what the photographs show is the weekly food consumption of the families. It's just such an amazing juxtaposition, where you can see the great differences. And it always strikes me as odd that the only people not smiling are up here. How on earth are we going to get through all that? And what are we going to do with the waste? Okay, so, you know, managing without growth has to start in that top quadrant there. So what I did was to build a model of the Canadian economy. I called it low grow. I'm not disguising the reason for my inquiry here. And I used it to try to answer a specific question. Can we have full employment, no poverty, fiscal balance, reduce greenhouse gas emissions without relying on economic growth? Very important question, because, you know, the assumption often is we need growth to solve these other problems. Well, here's the answer. You can simulate it on the computer, but that's a place to start. The output of the computer is not what you read off on the screen or from your printer. It's how it changes your thinking and what you learn about the world you're in. So that's really what I want to emphasize here. Okay, so what makes an economy grow? And I'm showing you these things for a couple of reasons. One is to try to answer this question, what makes an economy grow, but also to point out what is included in the model. Well, an economy grows if we spend more money. So if we spend money on consumption, that adds to growth. If we spend more money on equipment, it adds to growth. If the government spends more on goods and services, it goes into growth, into GDP. And if we run a trade balance, if we sell more to other countries than we buy, that goes into our GDP in a positive way. You can also look at growth on the supply side, you know, what we produce. I've modeled this in the simplest possible way. I have labor in the model as a total number. And the stock of capital, you know, labor working with equipment is what produces stuff. And productivity is an interesting factor because it can depend on so many things, on the ideas, on technology, on how we're organized. And in the model, productivity is represented
really by time. In other words, over time we become more productive, and then I allow myself to vary the extent to which we become more productive over the time. So those are all represented in the model. If you run the model forward from 2005 to 2035 with everything indexed at 100 at the starting point, what it really says is, what would the future of Canada look like in this very aggregate way if the next 30 years, starting from 2005, were like the previous 30 years? And it looks like this. So the black line is gross domestic product per capita. That's our average income. Of course, there's a big spread around that, so you don't get the full story from that, but that's a standard measure. Then we have greenhouse gas emissions rising, but not as fast. That's because we're getting some benefit from that reduction in intensity. Unemployment, according to the model, goes up a bit and comes down again. The debt to GDP ratio, this is the debt of all governments in Canada combined, slated to decline if you start back in 2005. That story has changed a bit now. But, you know, the policies we our governments have adopted is pretty much to get back onto this as quickly as we can. So it's still relevant to that extent. The thing that's most troubling here is the brown line. That's the Human Poverty Index. That's the UN's indicator of poverty. It consists of an income measure, of an adult illiteracy measure, and the expectation that you'll live beyond the age of 60. And you can see that even with all that growth, poverty would go up in this business-as-usual scenario. That's really because we're not doing anything significantly to reduce the percentage of people who are poor in this country as defined in that way, and there'll be more people because of population growth, so the index rises. So then I said, okay, I've got a model which reproduces or says something about how the economy is growing. I said, what would happen if, starting in 2010, we took out all of the sources of growth from the economy and phased them out over a 10-year period? So by 2020, none of these things would be growing. Well, you would expect it to be disastrous, and you'd be right. You see, unemployment just goes shooting up. Poverty follows it. The government's debt-to-GDP ratio gets completely untenable. Finally, the economy settles down over here. See, GDP per capita finally is stable, and greenhouse gas emissions do come down somewhat. Not much below where they started at, though. And it's this kind of scenario that people have in their mind, maybe they don't have a picture of it, when they think that we need growth, because they think that it's only by growth that we can avoid this kind of disaster. So the question is, can we do better? As I said, lots of people are involved in this debate. Here's Larry Elliott of The Guardian Weekly. He says, the real issue is whether it's possible to challenge the growth at any cost model and come up with an alternative that is environmentally benign, economically robust, and politically feasible. I spend most of my time on the first two, environmentally benign, economically robust, because unless we can show that, it'll never be politically feasible. But of course, just showing it doesn't mean it becomes politically feasible. This is a task in itself. So, I can show you a better scenario. That's what I'm going to do. Again, I put in some changes that start in 2010, phase them in over a 10-year period, and then you can see that towards the end of this scenario, we've got stable GDP per capita. We've no longer got growth. We've got greenhouse gas emissions down significantly. Unemployment has come down to a level lower than we've seen in 40 years in this country. The Human Poverty Index has come down. We would have the best record on poverty in the world if we were to track this. And still the government's debt to GDP ratio has stayed looking very healthy. So how do you do that? Well, it's actually a fairly complicated story, and it is covered in a chapter in the book. All I can do now is give you a quick sketch. Well, you have to regulate how much we spend and with how much we produce. And bring those into balance all the way along. And stability, and this is a very tricky issue, stability here, the GDP per capita, requires a stable population and stable labor force. The greenhouse gas emissions come down significantly because I did put a carbon price in the model. I said, well, if people had to pay to use the atmosphere for disposing of greenhouse gases, they would cut back. And they'll cut back the more, the higher the prices, and you can vary that when you run the model, and that's just one particular scenario there. The reduction in unemployment comes about from an assumed shorter work year, so that on average, Canadians are working less, and so, as Brian said, more people can share the work. Also, more generous anti-poverty programs to bring the Human Poverty Index down, because trickle-down doesn't work. Let me say something about this average hours of work, because that's really quite critical, because I think if we can't
see our way clear to stabilizing the economy and still maintaining employment levels, we've got an enormous task ahead of us. Turns out it may not be as difficult as it may seem. This shows the average hours Canadians spent working in 1961. It was above 2,000 hours. And you can see how it was declining fairly rapidly until about 1980. And then the rate of decline virtually ended. And so by 2006, 2007, we were working about 1,736 hours on average paid employment. In my scenario that I showed you where the unemployment rate comes down, I simply really continued that decline that we saw before on into the future. If we did that, we would be working on average 1,500 hours a year in paid employment by 2035. And you say, well, you know, is that reasonable? Is that unreasonable? The best way I have of answering that is to see what other countries are already doing. Look at that, 2007. Germany, Norway, and Netherlands already below 1,500 hours a year paid work. My last point, basically, is what would change if we were to move in this kind of direction that I've tried to lay out for you? Well, lots of things would change. I'm going to give you a list of some of the ones that strike me as important. And that I mentioned in the book. We need new measures of success. While we still use GDP and growth in GDP as our main measure of success, and it's in the media all the time, I think we're sunk. Because what happens is we gear our policies to the increase in the value of that number. And I'm glad to say there is quite a lot of work, like the Canadian Index of Wellbeing. It's not perfect, it's still being produced. If we think about well-being in a different and more comprehensive way, then our policies and our actions will be guided towards that. But it's not just something at the national level, it's something at the local level, at the individual level, the corporate level. All of this has to be addressed. I think we need to place much stricter limits on ourselves in terms of how much material, how much energy we use, and how much land we use up, because it's through land use that we displace other species so much. If we did that, our prices would become more meaningful. Things that were apparently not scarce would look more scarce. The struggle we're having to set limits on greenhouse gas emissions is just an example. But if we can do that, it will generate a significant price for carbon, and that will give us more meaningful prices of the things that use carbon. If we do that, I think we'll have more durable and more repairable products following automatically. You don't have to tell people that. You just have to give people better guidance through prices. This is a tough one. I don't have time to say much more about it now, but you know, so much of consumption is the pursuit of status. That's a zero-sum game, because anytime your status goes up because you bought something, someone else's status goes down. They get frustrated, they go and buy something. Terrible way to live, but we seem to do it. We need more informative advertising. It's a whole story in itself. I'm not an expert in it, but I'm troubled by the worldview that advertising by and large promotes and the values that it engenders. I think that's a really big problem for us. I think we need a better screening of technology. We seem to let new technologies run rampant and then try and solve the problems they create afterwards. We used to try and do a better job of that. I think we've got to bring that back. We definitely need a more efficient capital stock, more efficient housing, more efficient equipment, more efficient transport. But as I've said all along, that's not going to be enough. But it really is important. More local, less global, something your organization is clearly pursuing. I don't have to say any more about that. We've got to address the inequality problem, particularly if the economy is not growing. Because right now we often hear, we don't actually have to deal with inequality. We're all getting richer. Well, that's not even true, but the assumption is made that we're all getting richer and growth will solve the poverty problem. It doesn't do it, because poverty is more than simply income. It's all about social exclusion and such. So we'd have to address inequality more directly. Less work and more leisure, I've already said that. And in my own life, because I'm an educator, we have to make sure our education is for life, not just for work. But to sum it all up, I believe we have to knock economic growth off its pedestal. I love doing this because it seems so easy just to press the button and it's done. It is a big task and it's not easy. Can we adapt if we do this? Well, I think as individuals, there's no doubt that we are a very adaptive species. The problem is our institutions. Institutions which we look to be smarter than us, to take a longer view than we do, to take a more compassionate view than perhaps we do. But our institutions, to my mind, are letting us down more and more these days. That includes our universities, our commerce, our banks, our justice system, political system, religious institutions, global institutions. This is where my biggest problem comes, frankly, is the adaptability of our institutional structure. And I'm not at all sure we can do it. If we don't do it, though, if they don't adapt, the future looks pretty gloomy to me.
do. From what I've learned tonight, your organization is simply wonderful. This is where we're heading, I hope. And with that, I will thank you for your attention. I don't know if there's a plan for questions or, I mean, it's getting late, but whatever people want to do is fine with me.
The politicians at federal, provincial levels.
Well, I wouldn't use the word popular. But I have had occasion to speak to some politicians. The first, I mean, we have three levels of government. The first level that found my work of some interest was at the municipal level. I've spoken to opposition parties, but the government isn't calling me at the moment, at the federal level.
Just kind of wondering, Canada, you speak Canada and presumably the U.S. as wealthy countries, but there's an awful lot of Canadians and Americans that are just barely hanging on or are living in poverty. I mean, it's one thing to say the country is wealthy, but a lot of the people, maybe the majority of the people in the country, are not wealthy. How do we kind of address that situation? Because it's easy to talk about the wealthy country going first in anything, but you're talking about millions and millions of people that would just be totally fall off the shelf.
Yeah, no, I agree absolutely with you, which is one of the reasons why I made an effort to include poverty explicitly in my work. I guess I got two things to say about it. One is both countries you've mentioned are rich enough to do a much better job of eradicating poverty than we have chosen to do so far. It's not a lack of means. So that's the first point. Second point is that I think we've been sold a bill of goods, that poverty gets eradicated through growth. And so what that has allowed us to do, broadly speaking, is not to address poverty, but to pursue growth. And so here's the dilemma. If we were to simply stabilize the economy, kind of like freeze it as is, that would be terrible. And that's really what you're saying. But I think if we were to move in that sort of direction, we could not hide behind growth as the solution to poverty. We would have to, it would be part of the same dialogue, that as we stabilize the economy so that it doesn't continue to do even worse things to the environment, or doesn't or continues to depend on resources that are no longer going to be available, particularly on the energy side, we would have to couple that with a genuine effort to address poverty. And that's why when you look at transforming the economy in this way, it's not just an economic issue, it's not just an environmental issue, it's not just a poverty issue. I mean, it's a bringing together all of these things. And all I've tried to do really with this last part of the presentation is to show you that at least in terms of the numbers, we can do it. Let me just make one more final comment. I'll turn to you to ask a question. When I started this exercise, I was aware that Canada did not have an official definition of poverty. StatsCan uses this thing called the low income cutoff. Everyone else calls it the poverty line. So I said, well, how much would it cost to bring everybody in Canada at least up to that level? And I didn't know the answer. And I thought, well, you know, we're about a $1.5 trillion economy, something like that. If it's a couple of $100 billion a year, that's a big problem. $100 billion, that's also quite a big problem. When I discovered it was $13 billion, and in that year when I was doing the work, the combined surpluses of the government of this country was about $27 billion, I kind of thought, you know, this is a soluble problem, at least to that level. So that's kind of what I add to this discussion. It's some number crunching which says, you know, we could do this if we wanted to do it. So, yeah, I take your point, but it's not impossible.
Two questions, one very quick and simple, hopefully, and the other one maybe a little bit more involved. The simple one is, those intensity graphs that you showed, are they corrected for the effect of industrial offshoring in the UK and Britain? The slightly more difficult question, given that we've got a global finance system based on fiat currencies created as debt, all of which is repayable, that's compound interest,
yeah,
doesn't that create an inherent driver for ongoing growth? And if not, what's the workaround?
Right, okay. So the first question, very good question. The decline in intensity that I showed you for the three countries, I did mention the switch to gas as a big part of the explanation for Britain. you get a decline in intensity, or you can get it from multiple sources. If we move more into services and out of goods, so if we consume more services, that might be one explanation. If we produce services, like financial services, which we export, and we buy, which is what you're getting at, we buy materials, products from, say, China, so they're producing the greenhouse gases so that we don't have to.
Yeah.
You could also get that effect. So you're absolutely right. So it just really accentuates my point in a way, that it says that those, even those reductions in intensity might be a little bit...
artifactual.
Yeah, and that one has to look at the global picture. I did show some global information on intensity, although not greenhouse gas intensity. Just so that's a good point. As for the financial, I'm really glad you asked me that for a reason that may surprise you. A few years ago, I had a terrific student at York University, a fellow called Eric Miller. He happens to be sitting here in the front row because he lives in McMaster. He works in the provincial government, and he wrote a wonderful paper on this very issue. What is the requirements for a monetary system that would be consistent with a steady state economy? So if I wanted to, I could be really mean and say, Eric, you answer the question, because his essay was a lot better than I could have written on it. I think there's something to your point. The central point here, if people aren't aware of it, is that most of the money in our economy is not what's in our wallets. It's what banks write in their ledgers, or they type on their computers. If you go and get a loan, they just type into your account. You've now got $1,000 you didn't have when you went in there. But the argument is that the bank's only going to do that if you're going to pay, because you're going to pay them back with interest. So where's your interest going to come from if the economy is not growing? So that's the sort of the argument. I think, and it's something which, frankly, I'm going to devote the summer to nailing it down, because it's a very important issue. There are a couple of ways of thinking about this. One is, well, if that is the problem, then what we've got to do is change the way money is created in the economy, and that we've got to stop allowing banks to create money. How do you do that? You require them to have 100% reserves.
Yeah.
At the moment, they can lend out many, many more times worth of money, or create money, much more than they have money in the bank, on the assumption we won't all go and ask for our money back at the same time. So that's one approach, and that's the Herman Daly approach,
yes.
That we have 100% reserve requirement, and then all money is created by the central bank, and you create it at the rate you need it for the economy. Another perspective is that, in fact, money is largely created in response to what the economy needs, that it's not created externally, it's created in response. So if you had an economy that's not growing, you're going to have far fewer people going into the bank to borrow. And so it's not that there's this need to have growth to pay back what is borrowed, it's that there won't be as much borrowing for expansion in an economy that's not expanding, and so you don't get the same problem. That's what some writers are saying. I don't know where I stand on the issue. So, but it's a very important one that has to be wrestled with, and just by commentary, I don't have the financial sector in the model.
Yeah, saw that, yeah.
Yeah.
To reform the economy, as you showed with your model, I'm just wondering what sorts of actions you might expect the federal government, for instance, to have to engage in, and whether those sorts of actions, given the fact that most politicians are very self-interested and want to be reelected within 4 years, and I don't know what the time frame for improvement might be on some of these actions, to what extent are there political hurdles that are difficult to overcome given our current government system?
I think you know the answer as much as I do. You know, this won't be, and ought not to be, just a top-down process. I mean, it won't be. It can't be, given our kind of system. This is not the kind of future that a government can lead us to if we don't want it. So what we have to anticipate, if we're going to move in this sort of direction, is a sort of a combination of actions at all levels in society, right? From individuals making different choices to community groups doing different things. A lot of the things that you described this evening were very, very compatible with this sort of scenario. But there are some things that we can't, at the sort of local level, overcome unless there's leadership at the national level. There are some obstacles, even in the tax system, to spreading work among more people. So So companies prefer to pay time and a half sometimes than to spread the work to a second worker. So there are things that can be addressed, like the Dutch, for example, have a law which allows any employee of a company above a certain size to request flexible time at work. And the company can only deny that under very special circumstances, and most requests are allowed. Well, we don't have anything like that here. So there's lots that we can learn from other countries. Another point is, hasn't come up yet, but someone may be thinking of asking it, could we do this alone in Canada? Well, I don't know. I do write about that in the book, but I don't think that's really a very important question to spend time on. If we're going to make changes of this sort, it's going to be happening in many countries at the same time. You know, we're going to keep an eye on one another and so on. And that will make it easy. I mean, Canada, sad to say, doesn't have a history of being number one in, you know, we're happy with number two or three, you know. But that's why, one of the reasons I put up those international conferences, just to remind everybody that there is an international discussion going on. So, you know, I guess the leadership, if it comes from government, will come because someone there or some group there has really tuned in to changes that are happening, and then they get out in front of the group. So we got to want it, and they've got to facilitate it.
How do we control the global capitalism? At the present time, just after the war finished, Attlee came in to the Labour government, and one could only take £50 outside of Britain for a period of time. That, after a while, when the Conservatives came back in, it was eliminated. And now today, capitalists can take money and they can actually destroy a country by the speculation. How can we control that?
Well, we know how to do it, because, as you say, we've done it before. You have to have controls to prevent the flight of capital. So, in principle, we could do it. We've tied our hands somewhat since those times, because we've signed international agreements which limit our capacity to do that. That's, again, one of the reasons why I say that if there is an unfolding of this direction in several countries, then that problem becomes tractable once again. But it's a fundamental problem. You may notice that in my account, I don't think I used the term class once, you know, and the notion of class conflict and class interests. Really, that's what you're pointing to. And it's very troubling, because there's no way in which we will somehow all unanimously move in this direction together. But you're going to get some people, hopefully more and more, thinking it's the kind of future that we ought to have, but you're going to get very powerful interests opposing it. And, you know, that's into a political situation, a political contest that others are more expert than I am to talk about. But it's there. But, you know, I don't think it can be avoided, because I think the alternative, if you take peak oil, if peak oil hits and the price of oil starts going up and up and up, we saw a bit of that before the recession came, it'll be the same thing. You'll have a lot of class conflict, a lot of conflict in society. And so you have to ask yourself, which is the preferred way to go? Sort of blindly into the future, taking whatever comes at us because we're not smart enough to anticipate problems, or trying a more deliberate approach. I try to be upbeat about these things because often I speak to audiences which are a lot younger than I am, and it's not all true here. Nice to see some people of my own vintage, but we have to remain upbeat about it. We have to say these are very interesting challenges. We've got to work out how to overcome them and not get too depressed that we can't do it. So one more question. I'll take one on this side, isn't it?
I'm just wondering, are you involved in trying to get other, you know, looking at climate change is often through the environment, but cross-panel and, a broader perspective of bringing in, yourself and many other people from, the economic, perspective into, and then spreading this information out into the general public and universities, colleges, I think, sort of to make people more aware.
Well, I am, I suppose. I mean, I do it through my own teaching and writing, and I do quite a lot of talks of this kind. I happen to have written, I was very flattered in a way that Brian said my book was quite readable. I mean, I did. It's an academic book produced by an academic publisher, which means you can't go to Chapters and buy it. You can order it. You can actually buy one here tonight. It's a good discount. But but I didn't try to write a popular book, but I did try to write in a way that would be reasonably accessible.
But other people are writing more popular treatments of similar ideas. So that's really important. I also do a lot with the Suzuki Foundation. We've just gone through a long-range planning exercise and identified some new priorities for the organization, and two of them really appealed to me. One is transforming the economy that the foundation wants now to embark on, and secondly, changing the narrative, changing the stories that we tell ourselves, about our communities, about our country. Because in a way, that's really what I've tried to do here, is to say there's a different story we could tell about the economy if we want to do that. But it's not just about the economy, it's about life in general. So, I mean, those are the things I do. And, you know, what do we all do? We all sort of have to look to ourselves and say, what can I do? How can I contribute? I'm an academic now, so I do the academic thing. But I gave a whole course on my book this term to a group of marvelous students, and they're just gone off now, all sort of fired up. So I was very happy. Anyway, I guess that's time.
You might find it a bit difficult to find the book. You might have to go to the webpage to buy it. And that address is www.pvictor.com. Once again, this has been The Other Side of the News on CFMU. Thanks for listening. Redefining Radio. CFMU.